This is Unfortunate History.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to Unfortunate History. This is Cody Pennington, and I have Greg Skinner with me again. What's up, man?
I'm doing good, mate. I'm doing good. It's good to be back on the pod again. We're making good time with these, aren't we? We're really churning them out now.
We're trying our best to get these out as quick as possible, and hopefully before the coronavirus goes away, we'll have a lot of back catalog, because who knows how busy we'll be after that.
Well, like you say, it's either the coronavirus goes or it kills us all. So, yeah. Like I say, you could get as much entertainment out of us as possible.
Well, I would like us to be everybody's, like, deathbed podcast, you know? If we can do that, that'd be great.
That's what we're going for. We are incredibly unfortunate. So, like I say, if everyone's on their last words and that's that, then I hope that their last words are, stay unfortunate.
I know. It's just looking at, son, stay unfortunate.
I know you found that Nazi uniform of mine in the closet.
God,
but
no.
All you'll need to remember is just stay unfortunate, son.
No, man. I will make the statement now. Unfortunate History is not on the Axis side. We do not support the Nazis. And speaking of, that's actually a pretty good segue, because we are discussing some stuff to do with World War II today, which is really cool. Today we're discussing Tsutomu Yamaguchi, the Atomic Man.
The Atomic Man. I know he sounds very superhuman, but, well, I suppose you could probably say he is, because he survived the unsurvivable.
He did, yeah. I made it so that you don't know much about this story.
Nope.
Yeah, which is kind of a good common theme that we're having at the moment, is where Greg goes in blind and kind of learns with you listeners about the stories and that kind of stuff. And that's kind of the way I like doing it, because it helps me push the narrative that I'm telling to the listeners, because I can hear somebody reacting to it in real time.
I essentially know nothing, and Cody knows everything. Basically, we've come to a point now where he sends me a title and a tiny bit of an overview, and then we jump in. So I'm as literally almost as blind as you guys are. So I like to think that my responses to whatever he says will be similar to what you guys would be. So,
yeah, hopefully. Like we were saying just a few minutes ago, Yamaguchi was, I'm going to refer to him as Yamaguchi because I can't refer to him as his full name throughout the entire episode. I'm just going to, we really need to be careful with any sort of impersonations we do or an impressions we do during this episode. I don't want to offend anybody. So let's tread lightly on these impressions.
Okay.
But like Greg said, Yamaguchi actually survived the unsurvivable. Yamaguchi was actually in Hiroshima on the day it was bombed by the U.S. with the dropping of Little Boy, which was the first atomic bomb ever used in armed conflict.
That in itself is madness, because you think when a bomb of that magnitude drops, you think, no one survives through a nuke. People don't survive through nukes. It's just one of those things. When a nuke drops, it's just flat out, that place is gone now. So for people to survive through it, again, I've heard stories of, you know, people who have been, what, something like 20 miles, 30 miles, 40 miles away, and even they felt the effects of what this bomb was.
Yeah.
So for anyone who was in the city to survive it's kind of a big deal. The guy must have been kind of tough, you know what I mean?
Well, I think he was quite tough, but he also came up with a book of poetry later on, so I don't know. I mean, you know, I think that's tough. At least tough. He is in touch with his feminine side, but also survives nuclear attacks. So it's like, you know, the perfect guy.
You know what he can do? Honestly, he can do what he likes from now. Once you survive a nuclear bomb, if you want to write a book of poetry, that's fine.
Yeah,
it's still going to be the most masculine book of poetry ever released, because you survived an atomic bomb.
Absolutely. Well, there were undoubtedly numerous atrocities committed throughout the Second World War, both by the Axis powers and the Allied powers, depending on your point of view. But we know, obviously, of the Holocaust, as well as the bombing of Pearl Harbor due to the terrible Michael Bay film. And in the future, I have an episode planned that will discuss a number of World War II atrocities in depth, which will tie in to today's episode, but today, since this is a mini-sode, I don't know if I mentioned that or not, I think I did, we're going to discuss Yamaguchi specifically and his experiences. Now, Yamaguchi was an engineer employed by Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, an engineering, electrical equipment, and electronics company. And most of us know the name Mitsubishi, obviously cars, that sort of thing. But some don't know that it is a huge corporation of multiple smaller companies. It's kind of like Virgin, but with a much longer history. I think the first Mitsubishi company was made in like 1840 or 1870, something like that. So it's a huge conglomerate.
That's crazy, because I didn't know that, because when you said that just then, Mitsubishi, I thought, oh, I know that brand straight up off the bat.
Yeah, of course.
Again, from the cars and all that. But again, I didn't know they were that old. I wasn't aware that Mitsubishi was, it came from that far ago. I just thought it was a car company. So already, that is knowledge to me that he worked for Mitsubishi, and Mitsubishi comes from, what, the 1800s, did you say?
Yeah, 1800s. The first of the companies in the corporation was started in the 1800s. Really crazy. If I were to compare it to anything, it seems like, at the moment, Virgin is the best comparison for modern-day world, modern-day business in general, because obviously you have Virgin Airlines, cruises, mobile phones, and all that kind of stuff. So, but prior to his employment with Mitsubishi, Yamaguchi actually had served in the military, but he was reportedly pulled out of his service due to his knowledge of engineering. He apparently found a unique way to design ship hulls. Which never actually happened to me during my military enlistment. Nobody ever decided to pull me out due to my singing abilities, although I was forced to sing the Turkish national anthem a couple of times. I wasn't a POW in Turkey.
You never told me that, Cody. I didn't know that was a thing.
I don't really know all of it anymore.
Again, because I know you're a veteran. I also know you're a very good singer, but I never knew those two facts. Collided.
CodyPennington.com. Now, I think for the story to go ahead with the story, I do, obviously, like I said, we're going to have another episode that's going to discuss some of the World War II atrocities, which will likely include Pearl Harbor, and we're going to go into that in depth. And then we'll also probably bring up the atomic bombs as well, because obviously that was a terrible act and that sort of thing. Whether or not it was justified is a whole other story, but it was pretty heinous of a thing to do. But I think a good way to tie into this story is we're going to discuss why the bombs were dropped. We're also going to discuss what the bombs were, not in too much scientific detail, because that'll get crazy boring. And then we'll go into the events of Hiroshima and that sort of thing. Now, I won't go into too much scientific detail, because we'll likely talk about the bombs on the main episode of the World War II atrocities, but the atomic bombs were the product of the Manhattan Project, which a lot of people probably heard about, but that was the code name for the secret American project used to look into the use of nuclear weapons. And this project was actually spurred on by President Franklin D. Roosevelt after he received a letter from Albert Einstein, which warned that the Nazi forces were likely already working to develop a nuclear weapon themselves. But what actually led to the use of the atomic bombs was a mixture of a few things. One was the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. Now, there were two main motives for this attack. Firstly, America had actually cut off oil exports to Japan the same year, which nearly crippled Japan's navy. Japan received 80% of their oil from America.
80%? So, see, that's already still quite a lot. You know what I mean?
That is so much.
It kind of links in with what we're doing with the quarantine now, where self-employed people are getting 80% of their wages.
Yeah, wow. Way to make it hit home.
Oh, no, yeah.
Now, since America had cut off oil exports to Japan, Japan hoped that they could cripple the U.S. Pacific Fleet with their attack on Pearl Harbor, which would allow Japan to have free reign in the Pacific. That was one of the main goals. But the second main goal, Japan actually wanted to take over all of the U.S. and European-controlled Asian territories in the Pacific, creating an Asia for Asians, which is quote-unquote, I didn't say that, don't call me racist, but that's what is quoted as they were trying to create an Asia for Asians. But unfortunately for Japan, this attack just caused America to dive face first into World War II.
See, that's the last people you want jumping head first into a war. Is the United States.
Yeah.
Let's be real.
Yeah, you know absolutely. What I mean?
You really don't want them coming full force at you. And like I say, when it came to the World Wars, the US really did have a vendetta for the for Japan, didn't they? Ever since, obviously, since Pearl Harbor.
Well, that was the reason that they actually joined World War II. So obviously it happened, and then the next day America declared war on Japan. So they were instantly put into World War II. And Japan, they weren't really ready for it. Now, see, that was one of the reasons for the use of the atomic bombs.
Yep.
But another reason for the use of the atomic bombs was that Japan had resisted their surrender until 3 months after World War II had ended with VE Day. Mm-hmm. So 3 months after the Nazis had surrendered, Japan was still fighting a surrender. Now, this created a situation I like to refer to as a militarized dick measuring contest, and America decided to whip out every single inch.
That's the thing, though. That's the thing with the Japanese military and the Japanese army. Throughout time, they would never, ever accept surrender.
Yeah.
It's known throughout their... Like I say, in some ways, it's a credit to them. They will not surrender. They would rather... It's that sort of death before defeat attitude.
Yeah, or death with defeat. They would rather die 100% and, like, wipe out their entire country as opposed to admit defeat sort of thing.
What was that common, mate, that common way of suicide they had where they'd literally cut their own... In its open.
Oh,
and
wait, I know the name of this. Hold on. It is.
Come on.
Oh, hang on a second. I know I'm going to find it. I'm going to have to Google it.
Yeah, we got to Google it, but we know this.
Seppuku. Seppuku. We need to be careful.
No, we do.
We need to tread lightly.
We do.
We're kind of stomping all over these impressions.
But again, it says something about their people that they've got a history of people who are willing to do this, where, again, death before dishonor.
That's why Japan is the only country in the world that has a condition called death by overworking. I mean, that's the only, you know what I mean? I mean, it's a very hardworking and very, very honorable people.
If Britain had death by overworking, technically, I would have claimed that about 2 months ago. just because I work 9 to 5 for no reason, I've just gone, oh, death by overworking, see you later. But no, again, that is one of the things about Japan and that sort of country. They are very proud people, aren't they?
They are very proud people.
They do not
For good reason, for the fact that they have really rich history. They have a very rich history in their country in that. And I completely understand that. But you probably shouldn't bomb Pearl Harbor, you know?
Nope.
It's like, you just don't do it. And I don't think, I feel like I'm going to cut this out, but the Japanese shouldn't get into a militarized dick measuring contest with Americans. It's not going to work.
Because the Americans will keep extending inches.
Yeah, absolutely.
They will keep getting that ruler out. And like I say, again, I see a lot of things online about, again, you're an American, I'm a Brit.
What?
What? I do see a lot of arguments between the two about who's reasoning, but reasoning between World War II and as who won the battle, blah, blah, blah. Even though at the end of the day, the Allies won. So we're kind of all on the winning side.
Yeah. And now we buy PlayStations in mass. I mean, who really won? You know?
I have one, and it's an incredibly good console. I will give it that much.
Yeah. Well, before discussing the events of Yamaguchi's actual day during the bombing, we'll touch on a bit of the info about the atomic bombs. Now, the Manhattan Project created two separate atomic bombs, each performing in different ways. I'm going to avoid discussing, like I said, the truly in-depth science behind these bombs, but I'll talk a bit about their makeup. Now, the first bomb, which was dropped on Hiroshima, which is the one we'll be discussing with Yamaguchi, was actually codenamed Little Boy. This bomb weighed 9,700 pounds and used highly enriched uranium as its fuel source. The bomb contained a total of 140 pounds of uranium. Now, its explosive force was equivalent to 15,000 tons of TNT, or 30 million pounds of TNT, or 13,607,771 kilograms of TNT.
Jesus Christ, that's a big bomb.
Yeah, it's one bomb, though. So you imagine you have to have millions of pieces of dynamite to actually make the force that was behind this bomb. Now, the second bomb was codenamed Fat Man. This bomb was dropped on Nagasaki 3 days after Little Boy. And this bomb weighed 18,800 pounds and used highly enriched plutonium as its fuel source. It contained 13.6 pounds of plutonium, which is about the size of a football, an American football.
It was nicknamed the football, wasn't it?
No idea.
Was it not nicknamed?
No idea.
Okay.
The plutonium core was surrounded by 5,300 pounds of high explosives. This bomb was considered 10 times more efficient, if that's the proper word, than Little Boy. Its explosive force was equivalent to 21,000 tons of TNT, or 42 million pounds of TNT, or 19,050,880 kilograms of TNT. Well, now we'll get into Yamaguchi and his experiences in Hiroshima. Most of this information actually comes directly from Yamaguchi's own words, written in an essay that you can easily find by just Googling it. So try Googling it if you want to find this essay. It's about 25 pages long, and he wrote it for a university, I think, somewhere in Nagasaki or something like that. So if you want to see this information firsthand, read it, because we're leaving out quite a bit just because I'm trying to make this a mini-sode. But a few months prior to the bombing, Yamaguchi had been sent by his boss at Mitsubishi to Hiroshima on business. He had left his wife and three-year-old son behind at home, and he was accompanied by two of his colleagues. This was quite a while since the attack on Pearl Harbor, and the war had progressed to bombing raids on the Japanese mainland. Now, when describing the landscape from the train to Hiroshima, Yamaguchi recalled expecting to see a fuel warehouse on the coast, but it had been reduced to rubble due to the American bombings. However, up to this point, the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki had been largely unaffected.
Say, okay, that's interesting. So, as an Englishman, when it comes to bombing raids, we always think of the Germans and London and what we have. We don't, when we talk about history, we don't hear that much about what happened with the Americans and dropping the bombs on Japan.
It's very similar, actually. It's the way it's described. It was very similar to the bombing raids in London.
I feel like it would be, yeah, where the alarms would go off, that you'd go to an air raid shelter and you'd take cover and you'd hope with everything you've got that a bomb wouldn't drop directly on you.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was taught history, I learned very little about this.
You just don't really learn stuff outside your country, you know? Seems like there's a nationalism type aspect to especially historical teachings inside countries where they teach more about their nation's history as opposed to world history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even world history, it tends to be less. I mean, in America for world history, we'd learn about England, but we'd be less likely to learn about Japan other than, you know, the World War II and that sort of stuff. There's like so much less culture involved outside of your nation, almost, is what it seems like to me.
See, outside of Pearl Harbor, was there many other bombings in America?
No, we didn't give them the chance. We got bombed and we lost quite a few lives in Pearl Harbor, and then we basically said, "You are done." We just retaliated after that. And I think it was just after that point, it was just basically bombardment of air raids on Japan, mainland Japan, to get them to surrender. But they were very stubborn, I suppose, throughout that whole thing.
You've got two very historically stubborn nations.
Yeah.
I suppose Japan a lot more. America was essentially a much more young nation, but it's just, I suppose it was just the power of the period came to a head of, we're going to drop the biggest bomb ever made on you. Twice.
Thanks. Absolutely. Well, after arriving in Hiroshima, Yamaguchi and his colleagues reported to the Hiroshima shipyard. And the shipyard was described as basically an army barrack-like office with a steel-framed plant, small docks such as repair docks, and then a big sandy field that surrounded the entire plant.
Mm-hmm.
And the three men settled in and had pretty much a few months of relative peace in the city, or a few weeks, something like that. But throughout these peaceful days, the men spent some of their free time digging foxholes in the sandy field surrounding the plant, on the off chance that the Americans decided to, you know, bomb them or something. One morning at work, Yamaguchi describes hearing the blast of the air raid signal. He and all of the other employees ran to their foxholes, and he said that a distant bombing noise could be heard until he saw a giant armada flying directly towards them. Yamaguchi was frozen with fear until the armada suddenly changed course and actually flew towards the nearby Kure Naval Port.
Mm-hmm.
A two-hour battle ensued between the armada and the anti-air guns and battleships. Following the battle, Yamaguchi found out that the Kure Naval Port had been completely destroyed, but he had to sit in this foxhole. He actually said that the fear escaped him after a little while, and he just stood and watched this crazy two-hour battle that looked like something out of a film. He just watched it take place.
Right, so there was literally a air battle before the bomb was dropped. Is that what you're saying happened?
No, this was just a random raid.
Oh, was it?
So this is just a random raid that Yamaguchi had just so happened to be a part of. But there was nothing. I mean, it has nothing to do with the atomic bombs. Nothing whatsoever. It was just a tactical point from the Allied forces to take out this particular naval port.
Oh my God!
So it's really just an odd one. But I included in this information just to say that they literally spent their time digging foxholes when they got to this job, just in case they were bombed, and then they were bombed like a couple of days or weeks after that.
And to say that this guy has been through a bit already.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, following this attack, air raids became even more prevalent, and by July, people had actually started evacuations. But still, up to this point, both Hiroshima and Nagasaki were pretty much unaffected, the inner cities and that sort of thing. They still looked like beautiful cities. Now, even so, the cities were on blackout orders at night, just like the Blitz and the bombings in London. Now, it was around this time that Yamaguchi started having horrible nightmares where he was killed over and over and over again. And he stated that when he awoke from these nightmares, he began to wonder how he would kill his wife and child, because people apparently feared how they would die more than if they would die in Japan at this time, because it seemed like the bombings and the war was so close to home, they were just terrified about actually how they were going to die. So he would rather give his family a better death than for them to die slowly in a bad air raid.
See, that's insane.
Yeah.
Okay. Us two, we both have partners. You've got a child on the way, so
sure do.
Even more so to you. But I couldn't ever imagine thinking, how could I give my partner a better death? Like,
no, yeah, it's insane.
That's insane. I suppose it says what the time was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, I don't think definitely you or I have not had war raged in our backyards.
No,
like just a different way of living, and that's why it's so sad for people, for families and children, and you know, people, innocent people in the Middle East that have to deal with so much war time constantly. I mean, it's awful. I couldn't imagine having to deal with that. You know what I mean? You're scared to even go to school because the school might blow up. It's just insane.
See, I get upset having to get up for work.
Yeah.
and you hear about these stories where, you know, even in modern day in the Middle East and where these war-torn countries, and that kind of puts me in my place a little bit, as if to say, you know what, my life's kind of really good in comparison as to what has happened and to what is happening. I cannot complain because I have to get up at 5:30 and eat granola. That is the worst thing that happens to me.
Fucking fiber.
God damn it. I want Frosties. God.
For American friends, that's Frosted Flakes. Well, eventually, Yamaguchi's work had come to an end in Hiroshima, so he and his colleagues planned to return home. They were, unfortunately, held up on returning until August 6th, the day of the bombing. The three men made their way to the bus terminal, but just before boarding, literally they were in line to board, Yamaguchi noticed that he had left a really important seal that he needed for his job back in his dormitory, so he had to rush back to retrieve it. He found it, placed it in his pocket, and decided to have a cup of tea, for some reason, with a neighbor before making his way back to the bus terminal. I think that was pretty rude of him to do to his colleagues waiting at this bus terminal, but I think what they said was that there was no other buses for a long time. So he would never have made it back in time to see this, but so he just decided to have a cup of tea with this person. And weirdly enough, this person that he had the cup of tea with was somebody that he had worked with, and they had a discussion the day before. And the reason he ran into the person is that the guy decided to not go into work because they had a weird discussion the previous day, and they felt like there was a foreboding sense of just something awful coming. So that's how they ran into each other, and that's why he decided to have a cup of tea with him. Now, he took a tram to a separate station, which he would have to walk from to get to the bus station. Now, after arriving at the tram terminal, he had to cross a wooden bridge on his way to the bus terminal. It was at this moment that Yamaguchi caught sight of a woman in trousers, which he always describes her as a woman in trousers. She was walking towards him, and he thought he heard the faint roar of a B-29 bomber in the distance because he was, at this time, fairly used to the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman, who was about 20 meters away from Yamaguchi, looked into the sky with a look of terror and dismay. And he followed her gaze and looked in the same direction. He couldn't see the B-29 bomber, but he heard a nosedive-like sound in the sky and saw two small parachutes falling towards the ground. Yamaguchi instinctively dove into a nearby trench, and no sooner had he laid down than he felt an enormous bombing roar shoot through his entire body. He felt an unbearable heat on his side, and he was lifted into the air for an almost unbelievable amount of time. His wife and his child flashed through his mind, and he passed out, all of which happened in an instant, and he never saw that woman in trousers again.
That is madness. Looking in hindsight as to what these bombings were, which was at the time the most powerful bomb ever dropped, and throughout history has been the most powerful bomb ever dropped in wartime. It's hard to imagine what that must have been like. Because from what I hear, they don't actually hit the ground. They go off before they hit the ground. That's correct, isn't it? Yeah, they go off above ground.
I can't remember if it was this one or if it was Fat Man, but the bomb has a altimeter on it, or it gauges the height from the ground, basically, and it tells you your altitude. And then when it reaches a certain altitude, it detonates the bomb. So yeah, and it detonates above the ground and above the city, which is just terrifying. It's absolutely insane, especially that it happens literally in an instant and just destroys everything.
It's such a powerful concept. Even the concept of it is just, it wipes out everything.
That woman that he saw disappeared. He never saw her again. Obviously, you even hear stories about people's shadows being burnt into the concrete because it was so hot, and it really was. But he was lucky enough. I mean, he was in the trench, and it's unbelievable. He was incredibly lucky. There's no other way to say it. He wasn't just smart, doing the right. It was lucky. He was so lucky.
Because I've heard the stories from the pilots of the Americans where they weren't expected to survive this.
We'll likely get to that during the World War II atrocities episode and probably discuss directly from the pilots and then the loaders of the bombs and the guys that had to arm them, because I think this particular bomb they couldn't arm until they were up in the air just in case it went off accidentally. So obviously you got people on there that are just scared shitless the entire time.
Imagine being around that kind of power. Like, you've got this thing in front of you, and I've seen the footage where how they arm it. It's just a case of putting a few keys into it, and it looks so simple, but the thing is so powerful. It's madness.
It's terrifying.
It's literally terrifying. There's a reason it hasn't been used since.
Absolutely. There's definitely a reason. Well, Yamaguchi actually awoke in a separate trench from the one he dove into. And he awoke and collected himself, and he decided to make his way to the shipyard plant in hopes that he could find his two colleagues, because he was hoping that they hadn't actually gotten on a bus and they had waited for him. And then his thought process was that his colleagues would end up at the same shipyard plant to find him. Now, he arrived at the shipyard and did actually eventually find them. They were also two other survivors. And Yamaguchi actually stayed at the shipyard receiving first aid treatment until he and his colleagues were allowed to leave. And it was at this time that Yamaguchi decided that he had to make his way home to find his wife and children. And now, Greg, I actually left out a bit of specific information that's pretty pertinent to the story. Yamaguchi's home was Nagasaki.
What?
The second nuclear target for the American bombings.
See, I'm laughing. I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing because how sheerly... I suppose it suits us so well because of how unfortunate that is.
Honestly, the most unfortunate. It's very unfortunate.
Did they live?
We'll get to that.
Okay. I'll wait for that.
It's quite a bit of a shorter story now, because we're getting close to the end anyways. But after arriving in Nagasaki, Yamaguchi found that his arm was severely swollen. He had been given like cream and treatment and that sort of stuff, but he needed to receive medical attention. And luckily enough, he found an ophthalmologist, I think it was, that he had actually gone to school with. He found him, I think, very near to where he got off the train. And he convinced him to treat his arm, even though it wasn't necessarily what he was doing. And he just begged him, please treat my arm so I can get out of here and go see my family. The doctor pulled him into his office. He cut open his arm, drained all of the pus, and that alleviated the swelling in Yamaguchi's arm. And then he was bandaged up, and he made his way home. And he actually ended up at his parents' house because everybody had evacuated. and he knew his family wasn't at their particular house at the moment and that sort of thing. But eventually he actually did reunite with his family. And on August 9th, 3 days following the first bombing, Yamaguchi went to work early because that's what people do in Japan. And he was asked by all of his employees, he was bombarded with questions. How did you survive this? They wanted to know about the bomb. What happened? What was it? And he tried to answer them as best as he could, but eventually he said, I need to go see the boss. So he went to go speak to the boss, and the boss told him that he couldn't believe it. He could not believe that one bomb could have destroyed an entire city. And as he said this, there was another flash of light, and instinctively, Yamaguchi dove beneath the desk as the blast came through the entire building. And this time, Yamaguchi was able to avoid most of the blast, and he was able to escape the building, make his way out of the building into a nearby air raid shelter. And he actually survived.
This guy, you know, I respect this guy so much to come through two atomic bombs.
Yeah, and live.
That is madness. And live. That is madness. Also, when you were talking about his friend who treated him, I had an image of Robert Liston turning up.
Oh, God.
With the Liston off and going, you're losing this arm. But that's a different story.
Listen to our first episode on Robert Liston if you'd like to hear the story about that. It's very interesting. Go listen to it.
He would have had a field day upon this. Time me, gentlemen. Time me as limbs come off. But no, but that's what I'm saying is he's just mad that... How do you... You say that he was describing it to his boss as another bomb dropped. I feel like it's almost sitcom-esque.
It's
like,
ridiculous.
Out the window, he's like, yeah, this was terrible. It was awful as a bomb drops behind his back.
He's like, no, that couldn't have possibly happened. One bomb can't do all that damage. Well, I think now we do need to get to one of the unfortunate parts of this story. I think this is the most unfortunate, actually. After he survived both atomic bombs, Yamaguchi was a victim of restructuring, and he was laid off by his company that he was serving while he was in Hiroshima. What? I mean...
Oh my God, you took the words out of my mouth. I thought we wasn't allowed to say on this podcast, Cody. I've been saving the C word for so long. What?
I might block it out. I don't know. I might edit it out. Just put a little beep in there or something.
Leave it in there, Cody. Leave it in there. What utter... That is all. They laid him off.
Yeah, he laid him off. But he actually went on to do a lot of other stuff. He went on to do translations for the American military and that sort of thing. I guess he switched side. But he's like, I want to be on the winning side. But he went and did translation services for them and that sort of thing. And he went on to have a relatively happy life. And he went on to speak as an avid proponent of nuclear disarmament. So he was really, well, obviously he'd be a huge advocate for that. And although he's not the only survivor of the atomic bombs in general, he is recognized as the only person in history to have survived the actual blasts of the bombs. And it's absolutely incredible.
Even if you survived the blast, to survive the radiation.
Yeah.
Is a huge thing. So I just feel like his technique at diving behind things must be second to none.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the radiation. There's actually some parts of the story go into that. There's been claims that the radiation caused cancer, and that's actually what Yamaguchi actually died of. He died of cancer later on, but he actually died on the 4th of January, 2010.
Good God.
So he lived on to a very long life, even after the bombings. And I think he was 93 when he died. I think it's just incredible, incredibly lucky that the stuff he got away with.
You know what? He looked at what life gave him and he went, no. Yeah. I am not having this.
No, sir.
You can go fuck yourself. I will die when I'm ready to die. And he got to 94 and went, you know what? I'm ready. Because you don't survive two nuclear blasts, cancer, and whatever else was going on, and not be the toughest motherfucker going. This guy
is a very, very tough guy. And if you want, you can go buy his book on poetry.
You know, it might seem artsy fartsy. You got to remember what he's been through, and automatically you can wrap that in armor and bullets and go, he was tough. Let's be real.
It's like Clint Eastwood writing a book of poetry.
Yeah. Who's that American guy who was good at kung fu? What's his name?
Don't you dare say Steven Seagal.
No, not Steven Seagal. The other guy with a beard.
Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris. Yeah. This guy makes Chuck Norris look like nothing.
Yeah,
absolutely. I will put that out there now. I would put my money on him over Chuck Norris. You don't survive two atomic blasts and not have the biggest bollocks on the face of the planet. I'm going to put that out there now, and that is my statement from that.
That's probably what saved him from the blast. All right, everybody. That is the episode on Tsutomu Yamaguchi. Definitely an amazing person from history. Please, if you like I said, go check out his essay. You can Google it and find it. It's actually for the Nagasaki, one of the universities in Nagasaki. And then for the show, please, for the love of God, give us some follows and some interact with us on the social media. I love interacting with people on the social media. I've got I'm using Twitter a lot more. So if you want to follow us on Twitter, it's UnHistoryPod. If you want to follow us on Facebook or Instagram, it is at Unfortunate History. And then also I just got on Reddit for the company. It's Unfortunate History. The username's Unfortunate History. You'll probably be able to find it if you look for that. Anything, just follow us, please. And please, for the love of God, share with your family, tell a friend. We really, my goal for the 90-day downloads is to have at least 20,000 90-day downloads. And we're getting not there yet, but I think we could easily, I think we can get there if you guys just help us out and really, it's free, honestly. It's free to listen and it's free to share it with your friends and family. It just would really help us out. And obviously, we would really appreciate it if you could.
Like Cody says, just do what you can. If you like what you hear, subscribe, like, follow. Again, like Cody says, it costs nothing. And I hope, sincerely, you like what you hear.
Yeah, me too. Well, we got to go, guys, unfortunately. So just remember, please, stay unfortunate.
Stay unfortunate.
All right, bye.
Ta-ra, ta-ra.